With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with the Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Chapter 17 of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 3, Chapter 17, Supreme in Direst Peril. Another 10 days' wait. The great theologians of that treasury of all valuable knowledge and all wisdom, the University of Paris, were still weighing and considering and discussing the 12 lies. I had had but little to do these 10 days, so I spent them mainly in walks about the town with Noel. But there was no pleasure in them, our spirits being so burdened with cares, and the outlook for Joan growing steadily darker and darker all the time. And then we naturally contrasted our circumstances with hers, this freedom and sunshine, with her darkness and chains, our comradeship with her lonely estate, our alleviations of one sort and another, with her destitution in all. She was used to liberty, but now she had none. She was an out-of-door creature by nature and habit, but now she was shut up day and night in a steel cage like an animal. She was used to the light, but now she was always in a gloom where all objects about her were dim and spectral. She was used to the thousand various sounds which are the cheer and music of a busy life, but now she heard only the monotonous footfall of the sentry pacing his watch. She had been fond of talking with her mates, but now there was no one to talk to. She had had an easy laugh, but it was gone dumb now. She had been born for comradeship, and blithe and busy work, and all manner of joyous activities, but here were only dreariness, and leaden hours, and weary inaction, and brooding stillness, and thoughts that travel by day and night and day, round and round in the same circle, and wear the brain and break the heart with weariness. It was death in life, yes, death in life, that is what it must have been. And there was another hard thing about it all. A young girl in trouble needs the soothing solace and support and sympathy of persons of her own sex, and the delicate offices and gentle ministries which only these can furnish. Yet in all these months of gloomy captivity in her dungeon, Joan never saw the face of a girl or a woman. Think how her heart would have leapt to see such a face. Consider, if you would realize how great Joan of Arc was, remember that it was out of such a place and such circumstances that she came week after week and month after month and confronted the master intellects of France single-handed, and baffled their cunningest schemes, defeated their ablest plans, detected and avoided their secretest traps and pitfalls, broke their lines, repelled their assaults, and camped on the field after every engagement, steadfast always, true to her faith and her ideals, defying torture, defying the stake, and answering threats of eternal death and the pains of hell with a simple, "Let come what may, here I take my stand and will abide." Yes, if you would realize how great was the soul, how profound the wisdom, and how luminous the intellect of Joan of Arc, you must study her there, where she fought out that long fight all alone, and not merely against the subtlest brains and deepest learning of France, but against the ignoble deceits, the meanest treacheries, and the hardest hearts to be found in any land, pagan or Christian. She was great in battle, we all know that, great in foresight, great in loyalty and patriotism, great in persuading discontented chiefs and reconciling conflicting interests and passions, great in the ability to discover merit and genius wherever it lay hidden, great in picturesque and eloquent speech, supremely great in the gift of firing the hearts of hopeless men and noble enthusiasms, the gift of turning hares into heroes, slaves and skulkers into battalions that march to death with songs on their lips. But all these are exalting activities. They keep hand and heart and brain keyed up to their work. There is the joy of achievement, the inspiration of stir and movement, the applause which hails success. The soul is overflowing with life and energy. The faculties are at white heat. Weariness, despondency, inertia, these do not exist. Yes, Joan of Arc was great always, great everywhere, but she was greatest in the Rouen trials. There she rose above the limitations and infirmities of our human nature, and accomplished under blighting and unnerving and hopeless conditions all that her splendid equipment of moral and intellectual forces could have accomplished if they had been supplemented by the mighty helps of hope and cheer and light, the presence of friendly faces, and a fair and equal fight with the great world looking on and wondering. End of chapter 17. This is chapter 18 of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 3, Chapter 18, Condemned, Yet Unafraid. Toward the end of the 10-day interval, the University of Paris rendered its decision concerning the 12 articles. By this finding, Joan was guilty upon all the counts. She must renounce her errors and make satisfaction, or be abandoned to the secular arm for punishment. The university's mind was probably already made up before the articles were laid before it, yet it took it from the 5th to the 18th to produce its verdict. I think the delay may have been caused by temporary difficulties concerning two points. One, as to who the fiends were who were represented in Joan's voices. Two, as to whether her saints spoke French only. You understand, the university decided emphatically that it was fiends who spoke in those voices. It would need to prove that, and it did. It found out who those fiends were, and named them in the verdict. Belial, Satan, and Behemoth. This has always seemed a doubtful thing to me, and not entitled to much credit. I think so for this reason. If the university had actually known it was those three, it would for very consistency's sake have told how it knew it, and not stopped with the mere assertion, since it had made Joan explain how she knew they were not fiends. Does not that seem reasonable? To my mind, the university's position was weak, and I will tell you why. It had claimed that Joan's angels were devils in disguise, and we all know that devils do disguise themselves as angels. Up to that point, the university's position was strong. But you see yourself that it eats its own argument when it turns around and pretends that it can tell who such apparitions are, while denying the like ability to a person with as good a head on her shoulders as the best one the university could produce. The doctors of the university had to see those creatures in order to know, and if Joan was deceived, it is argument that they in their turn could also be deceived, for their insight and judgment were surely not clearer than hers. As to the other point, which I have thought may have proved a difficulty and cost the university delay, I will touch but a moment upon that and pass on. The university decided that it was blasphemy for Joan to say that her saints spoke French and not English, and were on the French side in political sympathies. I think that the thing which troubled the doctors of theology was this. They had decided that the three voices were Satan and two other devils, but they had also decided that these voices were not on the French side, thereby tacitly asserting that they were on the English side. And if on the English side, then they must be angels and not devils. Otherwise the situation was embarrassing. You see, the university being the wisest and deepest and most erudite body in the world, it would like to be logical if it could, for the sake of its reputation. Therefore it would study and study, days and days, trying to find some good common-sense reason for proving the voices to be devils in Article Number 1 and proving them to be angels in Article Number 10. However, they had to give it up. They found no way out, and so to this day the university's verdict remains just so, devils in Number 1, angels in Number 10, and no way to reconcile the discrepancy. The envoys brought the verdict to Rouen, and with it a letter for Cochon which was full of fervid praise. The university complimented him on his zeal in hunting down this woman, whose venom had infected the faithful of the whole West, and as recompense it as good as promised him a crown of imperishable glory in heaven. Only that, a crown in heaven, a promissory note, and no endorser. Always something away off yonder, not a word about the archbishopric of Rouen, which was the thing Cochon was destroying his soul for. A crown in heaven. It must have sounded like a sarcasm to him after all his hard work. What should he do in heaven? He did not know anybody there. On the 19th of May, a court of 50 judges sat in the archiepiscopal palace to discuss Joan's fate. A few wanted her delivered over to the secular arm at once for punishment, but the rest insisted that she be once more charitably admonished first. So the same court met in the castle on the 23rd, and Joan was brought to the bar. Pierre Maurice, a canon of Rouen, made a speech to Joan in which he admonished her to save her life and her soul by renouncing her errors and surrendering to the Church. He finished with a stern threat. If she remained obstinate, the damnation of her soul was certain, the destruction of her body probable. But Joan was immovable. She said, "If I were under sentence, and saw the fire before me, and the executioner ready to light it, more, if I were in the fire itself, I would say none but the things which I have said in these trials, and I would abide by them till I died." A silence followed now, which endured some moments. It lay upon me like a weight. I knew it for an omen. Then Cochon, grave and solemn, turned to Pierre Maurice. "Have you anything further to say?" The priest bowed low and said,
"Nothing, my lord."
"Prisoner at the bar, have you anything further to say?"
"Nothing."
"Then the debate is closed. Tomorrow sentence will be pronounced. Remove the prisoner." She seemed to go from the place erect and noble, but I do not know. My sight was dim with tears. Tomorrow, 24th of May, exactly a year since I saw her go speeding across the plain at the head of her troops, her silver helmet shining, her silvery cape fluttering in the wind, her white plumes flowing, her sword held aloft. Saw her charge the Burgundian camp three times and carry it. Saw her wheel to the right and spur for the Duke's reserves. Saw her fling herself against it in the last assault she was ever to make. And now that fatal day was come again, and see what it was bringing. End of chapter 18. This is chapter 19 of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 3, Chapter 19, Our Last Hopes of Rescue Fail. Joan had been adjudged guilty of heresy, sorcery, and all the other terrible crimes set forth in the 12 Articles, and her life was in Cochon's hands at last. He could send her to the stake at once. His work was finished now, you think? He was satisfied? Not at all. What would his archbishopric be worth if the people should get the idea into their heads that this faction of interested priests, slaving under the English lash, had wrongly condemned and burned Joan of Arc, deliverer of France? That would be to make of her a holy martyr. Then her spirit would rise from her body's ashes, a thousandfold reinforced, and sweep the English domination into the sea, and Cochon along with it. No, the victory was not complete yet. Joan's guilt must be established by evidence which would satisfy the people. Where was that evidence to be found? There was only one person in the world who could furnish it, Joan of Arc herself. She must condemn herself, and in public, at least, she must seem to do it. But how was this to be managed? Weeks had been spent already in trying to get her to surrender. Time wholly wasted. What was to persuade her now? Torture had been threatened. The fire had been threatened. What was left? Illness, deadly fatigue, and the sight of the fire, the presence of the fire. That was left. Now that was a shrewd thought. She was but a girl, after all, and, under illness and exhaustion, subject to a girl's weaknesses. Yes, it was shrewdly thought. She had tacitly said herself that under the bitter pains of the rack they would be able to extort a false confession from her. It was a hint worth remembering, and it was remembered. She had furnished another hint at the same time, that as soon as the pains were gone she would retract the confession. That hint was also remembered. She had, herself, taught them what to do, you see. First, they must wear out her strength, then frighten her with the fire. Second, while the fright was on her, she must be made to sign a paper. But she would demand a reading of the paper. They could not venture to refuse this, with the public there to hear. Suppose that during the reading her courage should return. She would refuse to sign then. Very well, even that difficulty could be got over. They could read a short paper of no importance, then slip a long and deadly one into its place, and trick her into signing that. Yet there was still one other difficulty. If they made her seem to abjure, that would free her from the death penalty. They could keep her in a prison of the church, but they could not kill her. That would not answer, for only her death would content the English. Alive she was a terror, in a prison or out of it. She had escaped from two prisons already. But even that difficulty could be managed. Cochon would make promises to her. In return, she would promise to leave off the male dress. He would violate his promises, and that would so situate her that she would not be able to keep hers. Her lapse would condemn her to the stake, and the stake would be ready. These were the several moves. There was nothing to do but to make them, each in its order, and the game was won. One might almost name the day that the betrayed girl, the most innocent creature in France and the noblest, would go to her pitiful death. The world knows now that Cochon's plan was as I have sketched it to you, but the world did not know it at that time. There are sufficient indications that Warwick and all the other English chiefs except the highest one, the Cardinal of Winchester, were not let into the secret, also that only Loiseleur and Beaupère on the French side knew the scheme. Sometimes I have doubted if even Loiseleur and Beaupère knew the whole of it at first. However, if any did, it was these two. It is usual to let the condemned pass their last night of life in peace, but this grace was denied to poor Joan, if one may credit the rumors of the time. Loiseleur was smuggled into her presence, and in the character of priest, friend, and secret partisan of France and hater of England, he spent some hours in beseeching her to do the only right and righteous thing, submit to the church, as a good Christian should, and that then she would straightway get out of the clutches of the dreaded English and be transferred to the church's prison, where she would be honorably used and have women about her for jailers. He knew where to touch her. He knew how odious to her was the presence of her rough and profane English guards. He knew that her voices had vaguely promised something which she interpreted to be escape, rescue, release of some sort, and the chance to burst upon France once more and victoriously complete the great work which she had been commissioned of heaven to do. Also there was that other thing. If her failing body could be further weakened by loss of rest and sleep now, her tired mind would be dazed and drowsy on the morrow, and in ill condition to stand out against persuasions, threats, and the sight of the stake, and also be purblind to traps and snares which it would be swift to detect when in its normal estate. I do not need to tell you that there was no rest for me that night, nor for Noel. We went to the main gate of the city before nightfall with a hope in our minds, based upon that vague prophecy of Joan's voices which seemed to promise a rescue by force at the last moment. The immense news had flown swiftly far and wide that at last Joan of Arc was condemned, and would be sentenced and burned alive on the morrow. and so crowds of people were flowing in at the gate, and other crowds were being refused admission by the soldiery, these being people who brought doubtful passes or none at all. We scanned these crowds eagerly, but there was nothing about them to indicate that they were our old war comrades in disguise, and certainly there were no familiar faces among them. And so, when the gate was closed at last, we turned away, grieved, and more disappointed than we cared to admit, either in speech or thought. The streets were surging tides of excited men. It was difficult to make one's way. Toward midnight, our aimless tramp brought us to the neighborhood of the beautiful church of Saint-Ouen, and there all was bustle and work. The square was a wilderness of torches and people, and through a guarded passage dividing the pack, laborers were carrying planks and timbers and disappearing with them through the gate of the churchyard. We asked what was going forward. The answer was, "Scaffolds and the stake. Don't you know that the French witch is to be burned in the morning?" Then we went away. We had no heart for that place. At dawn we were at the city gate again, this time with a hope which our wearied bodies and fevered minds magnified into a large probability. We had heard a report that the abbot of Jumièges, with all his monks, was coming to witness the burning. Our desire, abetted by our imagination, turned those 900 monks into Joan's old campaigners, and their abbot into La Hire, or the Bastard, or D'Alençon, and we watched them file in unchallenged, the multitude respectfully dividing and uncovering while they passed. With our hearts in our throats and our eyes swimming with tears of joy and pride and exultation. And we tried to catch glimpses of the faces under the cowls, and were prepared to give signal to any recognized face that we were Joan's men, and ready and eager to kill and be killed in the good cause. How foolish we were! But we were young, you know, and youth hopeth all things, believeth all things. End of chapter 19. This is chapter 20 of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 3, Chapter 20, The Betrayal. In the morning I was at my official post. It was on a platform raised the height of a man, in the churchyard, under the eaves of Saint-Ouen. On this same platform was a crowd of priests and important citizens, and several lawyers. Abreast it, with a small space between, was another and larger platform, handsomely canopied against sun and rain, and richly carpeted. Also it was furnished with comfortable chairs, and with two which were more sumptuous than the others, and raised above the general level. One of these two was occupied by a prince of the royal blood of England, His Eminence the Cardinal of Winchester, the other by Cochon, Bishop of Beauvais. In the rest of the chairs sat three bishops, the vice-inquisitor, eight abbots, and the 62 friars and lawyers who had sat as Joan's judges in her late trials. 20 steps in front of the platforms was another, a table-topped pyramid of stone, built up in retreating courses, thus forming steps. Out of this rose that grisly thing, the stake. About the stake bundles of faggots and firewood were piled. On the ground at the base of the pyramid stood three crimson figures, the executioner and his assistants. At their feet lay what had been a goodly heap of brands, but was now a smokeless nest of ruddy coals. A foot or two from this was a supplemental supply of wood and faggots compacted into a pile shoulder-high and containing as much as 6 pack-horse loads. Think of that! We seem so delicately made, so destructible, so insubstantial. Yet it is easier to reduce a granite statue to ashes than it is to do that with a man's body. The sight of the stake sent physical pains tingling down the nerves of my body, and yet, turn as I would, my eyes would keep coming back to it. Such fascination has the gruesome and the terrible for us. The space occupied by the platforms and the stake was kept open by a wall of English soldiery, standing elbow to elbow, erect and stalwart figures, fine and sightly in their polished steel, while from behind them on every hand stretched far away a level plain of human heads, and there was no window and no housetop within our view, howsoever distant, but was black with patches and masses of people. But there was no noise, no stir. It was as if the world was dead. The impressiveness of this silence and solemnity was deepened by a leaden twilight, for the sky was hidden by a pall of low-hanging storm clouds, and above the remote horizon faint winkings of heat-lightning played, and now and then one caught the dull mutterings and complainings of distant thunder. At last the stillness was broken. From beyond the square rose an indistinct sound, but familiar, court, crisp phrases of command. Next I saw the plain of heads dividing, and the steady swing of a marching host was glimpsed between. My heart leapt for a moment. Was it La Hire and his hellions? No, that was not their gait. No, it was the prisoner and her escort. It was Joan of Arc under guard that was coming. My spirit sank as low as they had been before. Weak as she was, they made her walk. They would increase her weakness all they could. The distance was not great. It was but a few hundred yards. But short as it was a heavy tax upon one who had been lying chained in one spot for months, and whose feet had lost their powers from inaction. Yes, and for a year Joan had known only the cool damps of a dungeon, and now she was dragging herself through this sultry summer heat, this airless and suffocating void. As she entered the gate, drooping with exhaustion, there was that creature Loiseleur at her side with his head bent to her ear. We knew afterward that he had been with her again this morning in the prison, wearying her with his persuasions and enticing her with false promises, and that he was now still at the same work at the gate, imploring her to yield everything that would be required of her, and assuring her that if she would do this, all would be well with her. She would be rid of the dreaded English, and find safety in the powerful shelter and protection of the church. A miserable man, a stony-hearted man. The moment Joan was seated on the platform, she closed her eyes and allowed her chin to fall, and so sat, with her hands nestling in her lap, indifferent to everything, caring for nothing but rest. And she was so white again, white as alabaster. How the faces of that packed mass of humanity lighted up with interest, and with what intensity all eyes gazed upon this fragile girl! And how natural it was, for these people realized that at last they were looking upon that person whom they had so long hungered to see, a person whose name and fame filled all Europe, and made all other names and all other renowns insignificant by comparisons. Joan of Arc, the wonder of the time, and destined to be the wonder of all times. And I could read, as by print, in their marveling countenances, the words that were drifting through their minds. Can it be true? Is it believable that it is this little creature, this girl, this child with the good face, the sweet face, the beautiful face, the dear and bonny face, that has carried fortresses by storm, charged at the head of victorious armies, blown the might of England out of her path with a breath, and fought a long campaign, solitary and alone, against the massed brains and learning of France, and had won it if the fight had been fair? Evidently Cochon had grown afraid of Manchon because of his pretty apparent leanings toward Joan, for another recorder was in the chief place here, which left my master and me nothing to do but sit idle and look on. Well, I supposed that everything had been done which could be thought of to tire Joan's body and mind. But it was a mistake. One more device had been invented. This was to preach a long sermon to her in that oppressive heat. When the preacher began, she cast up one distressed and disappointed look, then dropped her head again. This preacher was Guillaume Erard, an oratorical celebrity. He got his text from the 12 lies. He emptied upon Joan all the calumnies in detail that had been bottled up in that mass of venom, and called her all the brutal names that the 12 were labeled with, working himself into a whirlwind of fury as he went on. But his labors were wasted. She seemed lost in dreams. She made no sign. She did not seem to hear. At last he launched this apostrophe. O France, how hast thou been abused! Thou hast always been the home of Christianity! But now Charles, who calls himself thy king and governor, endorses, like the heretic and schismatic that he is, the words and deeds of a worthless and infamous woman." Joan raised her head, and her eyes began to burn and flash. The preacher turned to her. "It is to you, Joan, that I speak, and I tell you that your king is schismatic and a heretic." Ah, he might abuse her to his heart's content. She could endure that, but to her dying moment she could never hear in patience a word against that ingrate, that treacherous dog, our king, whose proper place was here, at this moment, sword in hand, routing these reptiles and saving this most noble servant that ever king had in this world, and he would have been there if he had not been what I have called him. Joan's loyal soul was outraged, and she turned upon the preacher and flung out a few words with a spirit which the crowd recognized as being in accordance with the Joan of Arc traditions.
"By my faith, sir, I make bold to say and swear, on pain of death, that he is the most noble Christian of all Christians, and the best lover of the faith and the church."
There was an explosion of applause from the crowd, which angered the preacher, for he had been aching long to hear an expression like this, and now that it was come at last, it had fallen to the wrong person. He had done all the work, the other had carried off all the spoil. He stamped his foot and shouted to the sheriff,
"Make her shut up!"
That made the crowd laugh. A mob has small respect for a grown man who has to call on a sheriff to protect him from a sick girl. Joan had damaged the preacher's cause more with one sentence than he had helped it with 100, so he was much put out, and had trouble to get a good start again. But he needn't have bothered. There was no occasion. It was mainly an English-feeling mob. It had but obeyed a law of our nature, an irresistible law, to enjoy and applaud a spirited and promptly delivered retort, no matter who makes it. The mob was with the preacher. It had been beguiled for a moment, but only that. It would soon return. It was there to see this girl burnt, so that it got that satisfaction, without too much delay. It would be content. Presently the preacher formally summoned Joan to submit to the church. He made the demand with confidence, for he had gotten the idea from Loiseleur and Beaupère that she was worn to the bone, exhausted, and would not be able to put forth any more resistance. And, indeed, to look at her, it seemed that they must be right. Nevertheless, she made one more effort to hold her ground, and said wearily,
"As to that matter, I have answered my judges before. I have told them to report all that I have said and done to our Holy Father the Pope, to whom, and to God first, I appeal."
Again, out of her native wisdom, she had brought those words of tremendous import, but was ignorant of their value. But they could have availed her nothing in any case now, with the stake there and these thousands of enemies about her. Yet they made every churchman there blench, and the preacher changed the subject with all haste. Well might those criminals blench, for Joan's appeal of her case to the Pope stripped Cochon at once of jurisdiction over it, and annulled all that he and his judges had already done in the matter, and all that they should do in it henceforth. Joan went on presently to reiterate, after some further talk, that she had acted by command of God in her deeds and utterances. Then, when an attempt was made to implicate the king, and friends of hers and his, she stopped that. She said,
"I charge my deeds and words upon no one, neither upon my king nor any other. If there is any fault in them, I am responsible, and no other."
She was asked if she would not recant those of her words and deeds which had been pronounced evil by her judges. Her answer made confusion and damage again.
"I submit them to God and the Pope."
The Pope once more. It was very embarrassing. Here was a person who was asked to submit her case to the church, and who frankly consents, offers to submit it to the very head of it. What more could anyone require? How was one to answer such a formidably unanswerable answer as that? The worried judges put their heads together and whispered and planned and discussed. Then they brought forth this sufficiently shambling conclusion, but it was the best they could do in so close a place. They said the Pope was so far away, and it was not necessary to go to him anyway, because the present judges had sufficient power and authority to deal with the present case, and were in effect the church to that extent. At another time they could have smiled at this conceit, but not now. They were not comfortable enough now. The mob was getting impatient. It was beginning to put on a threatening aspect. It was tired of standing, tired of the scorching heat, and the thunder was coming nearer. The lightning was flashing brighter. It was necessary to hurry this matter to a close. Erard showed Joan a written form, which had been prepared and made all ready beforehand, and asked her to abjure.
Abjure? What is abjure?
She did not know the word. It was explained to her by Monsieur. She tried to understand, but she was breaking under exhaustion, and she could not gather the meaning. It was all a jumble and confusion of strange words. In her despair she sent out this beseeching cry,
"I appeal to the Church Universal, whether I ought to abjure or not."
Erard exclaimed,
"You shall abjure instantly, or instantly be burnt."
She glanced up at those awful words, and for the first time she saw the stake and the mass of red coals, redder and angrier than ever now under the constantly deepening storm gloom. She gasped and staggered up out of her seat, muttering and mumbling incoherently, and gazed vacantly upon the people and the scene about her like one who is dazed, or thinks he dreams, and does not know where he is. The priests crowded about her, imploring her to sign the paper. There were many voices beseeching and urging her at once. There was great turmoil and shouting and excitement among the populace and everywhere.
"Sign! Sign!" from the priests.
"Sign! Sign and be saved!"
And Loiseleur was urging at her ear,
"Do as I told you. Do not destroy yourself."
Joan said plaintively to these people,
"Ah! You do not do well to seduce me."
The judges joined their voices to the others. Yes, even the iron in their hearts melted, and they said,
"Oh, Joan, we pity you so. Take back what you have said, or we must deliver you up to punishment."
And now there was another voice. It was from the other platform, pealing solemnly above the din. Cochon's reading the sentence of death. Joan's strength was all spent. She stood looking about her in a bewildered way a moment, then slowly she sank to her knees and bowed her head and said,
"I submit."
They gave her no time to reconsider. They knew the peril of that. The moment the words were out of her mouth, Monsieur was reading to her the abjuration, and she was repeating the words after him mechanically, unconsciously, and smiling, for her wandering mind was far away in some happier world. Then this short paper of 6 lines was slipped aside, and a long one of many pages was smuggled into its place, and she, noting nothing, put her mark on it, saying, in pathetic apology, that she did not know how to write. But a secretary of the King of England was there to take care of that defect. He guided her hand with his own and wrote her name, Jehanne. The great crime was accomplished. She had signed. What? She did not know. But the others knew. She had signed a paper confessing herself a sorceress, a dealer with devils, a liar, a blasphemer of God and his angels, a lover of blood, a promoter of sedition, cruel, wicked, commissioned of Satan, and this signature of hers bound her to resume the dress of a woman. There were other promises, but that one would answer without the others, and that one could be made to destroy her. Loiseleur pressed forward and praised her for having done such a good day's work, but she was still dreamy. She hardly heard. Then Cochon pronounced the words which dissolved the excommunication and restored her to her beloved church with all the dear privileges of worship. Ah, she heard that. You could see it in the deep gratitude that rose in her face and transfigured it with joy. But how transient was that happiness! For Cochon, without a tremor of pity in his voice, added these crushing words,
"And that she may repent of her crimes and repeat them no more, she is sentenced to perpetual imprisonment, with the bread of affliction and the water of anguish.
Perpetual imprisonment. She had never dreamed of that. Such a thing had never been hinted to her by Loiseleur or by any other. Loiseleur had distinctly said and promised that all would be well with her, and the very last words spoken to her by Erard on that very platform, when he was urging her to abjure, was a straight, unqualified promise that if she would do it, she should go free from captivity. She stood stunned and speechless a moment. Then she remembered, with such solacement as the thought could furnish, that by another clear promise made by Cochon himself, she would at least be the Church's captive, and have women about her in place of a brutal foreign soldiery. So she turned to the body of priests and said with a sad resignation,
"Now, you men of the Church, take me to your prison, and leave me no longer in the hands of the English."
And she gathered up her chains and prepared to move. But alas, now came these shameful words from Cochon, and with them a mocking laugh.
"Take her to the prison whence she came!"
Poor abused girl! She stood dumb, smitten, paralyzed. It was pitiful to see. She had been beguiled, lied to, betrayed. She saw it all now. The rumbling of a drum broke upon the stillness, and for just one moment she thought of the glorious deliverance promised by her voices. I read it in the rapture that lit her face. Then she saw what it was, her prison escort, and that light faded, never to revive again. And now her head began a piteous rocking motion, swaying slowly this way and that, as is the way when one is suffering unwordable pain, or when one's heart is broken. Then, drearily, she went from us, with her face in her hands, and sobbing bitterly. End of chapter 20. This is chapter 21 of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 3, Chapter 21, Respited Only for Torture. There is no certainty that anyone in all Rouen was in the secret of the deep game which Cochon was playing, except the Cardinal of Winchester. Then you can imagine the astonishment and stupefaction of that vast mob gathered there, and those crowds of churchmen assembled on the two platforms, when they saw Joan of Arc moving away, alive and whole, slipping out of their grip at last, after all this tedious waiting, all this tantalizing expectancy. Nobody was able to stir or speak for a while, so paralyzing was the universal astonishment, so unbelievable the fact that the stake was actually standing there unoccupied, and its prey gone. Then, suddenly, everybody broke into a fury of rage. Maledictions and charges of treachery began to fly freely. Yes, and even stones. A stone came near killing the Cardinal of Winchester. It just missed his head. But the man who threw it was not to blame, for he was excited, and a man who is excited never can throw straight. The tumult was very great indeed for a while. In the midst of it, a chaplain of the Cardinal even forgot the proprieties so far as to opprobriously assail the august Bishop of Beauvais himself, shaking his fist in his face and shouting, "By God, you are a traitor!" "You lie," responded the bishop. He a traitor? Oh, far from it. He certainly was the last Frenchman that any Briton had a right to bring that charge against. The Earl of Warwick lost his temper, too. He was a doughty soldier, but when it came to the intellectuals, when it came to delicate chicane and scheming and treachery, he couldn't see any further through a millstone than another. So he burst out in his frank warrior fashion, and swore that the King of England was being treacherously used, and that Joan of Arc was going to be allowed to cheat the stake. But they whispered comfort into his ear. "Give yourself no uneasiness, my lord. We shall soon have her again." Perhaps the like tidings found their way all around, for good news travels fast, as well as bad. At any rate, the ragings presently quieted down, and the huge concourse crumbled apart and disappeared. And thus we reached the noon of that fearful Thursday. We two youths were happy, happier than any words can tell, for we were not in the secret any more than the rest. Joan's life was saved. We knew that, and that was enough. France would hear of this day's infamous work, and then, why, then her gallant sons would flock to her standard by thousands and thousands, multitudes upon multitudes, and their wrath would be like the wrath of the ocean when the storm winds sweep it, and they would hurl themselves against this doomed city and overwhelm it like the resistless tides of that ocean, and Joan of Arc would march again. In 6 days, 7 days, 1 short week, noble France, grateful France, indignant France, would be thundering at these gates. Let us count the hours, let us count the minutes, let us count the seconds. Oh, happy day, oh, day of ecstasy, how our hearts sang in our bosoms! For we were young then. Yes, we were very young. Do you think the exhausted prisoner was allowed to rest and sleep after she had spent the small remnant of her strength in dragging her tired body back to the dungeon? No, there was no rest for her, with those sleuth-hounds on her track. Cochon and some of his people followed her to her lair straightway. They found her dazed and dull, her mental and physical forces in a state of prostration. They told her she had abjured, that she had made certain promises, among them, to resume the apparel of her sex, and that if she relapsed, the church would cast her out for good and all. She heard the words, but they had no meaning to her. She was like a person who has taken a narcotic and is dying for sleep, dying for rest from nagging, dying to be let alone, and who mechanically does everything the persecutor asks, taking but dull note of the things done, and but dully recording them in the memory. And so Joan put on the gown which Cochon and his people had brought, and would come to herself by and by, and have at first but a dim idea as to when and how the change had come about. Cochon went away happy and content. Joan had resumed woman's dress without protest. Also, she had been formally warned against relapsing. He had witnesses to these facts. How could matters be better? But suppose she should not relapse? Why, then she must be forced to do it. Did Cochon hint to the English guards that thenceforth, if they chose to make their prisoner's captivity crueler and bitterer than ever, no official notice would be taken of it? Perhaps so, since the guards did begin that policy at once, and no official notice was taken of it. Yes, from that moment Joan's life in that dungeon was made almost unendurable. Do not ask me to enlarge upon it. I will not do it. End of chapter 21. This is chapter 22 of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 3, Chapter 22, Joan Gives the Fatal Answer. Friday and Saturday were happy days for Noel and me. Our minds were full of our splendid dream of France aroused. France shaking her mane. France on the march. France at the gates. Rouen in ashes and Joan free. Our imagination was on fire. We were delirious with pride and joy, for we were very young, as I have said. We knew nothing about what had been happening in the dungeon in the yester-afternoon. We supposed that as Joan had abjured and been taken back into the forgiving bosom of the church, she was being gently used now, and her captivity made as pleasant and comfortable for her as the circumstances would allow. So, in high contentment, we planned out our share in the great rescue, and fought our part of the fight over and over again during those 2 happy days, as happy days as ever I have known. Sunday morning came. I was awake, enjoying the balmy, lazy weather, and thinking. Thinking of the rescue, what else? I had no other thought now. I was absorbed in that, drunk with the happiness of it. I heard a voice shouting far down the street, and soon it came nearer, and I caught the words, "Joan of Arc has relapsed! The witch's time has come!" It stopped my heart. It turned my blood to ice. That was more than 60 years ago, but that triumphant note rings as clear in my memory today as it rang in my ear that long-vanished summer morning. We are so strangely made. The memories that could make us happy pass away. It is the memories that break our hearts that abide. Soon
other voices took up that cry. Tens, scores, hundreds of voices. All the world seemed filled with the brutal joy of it. And there were other clamors, the clatter of rushing feet, merry congratulations, bursts of coarse laughter, the rolling of drums, the boom and crash of distant bands profaning the sacred day with the music of victory and thanksgiving. About the middle of the afternoon came a summons for Manchon and me to go to Joan's dungeon, a summons from Cochon. But by that time distrust had already taken possession of the English and their soldiery again, and all Rouen was in an angry and threatening mood. We could see plenty of evidences of this from our own windows, fist-shaking, black looks, tumultuous tides of furious men billowing by along the street. And we learned that up at the castle things were going very badly indeed, that there was a great mob gathered there who considered the relapse a lie and a priestly trick, and among them many half-drunk English soldiers. Moreover, these people had gone beyond words. They had laid hands upon a number of churchmen who were trying to enter the castle, and it had been difficult work to rescue them and save their lives. And so Manchon refused to go. He said he would not go a step without a safeguard from Warwick. So next morning Warwick sent an escort of soldiers, and then we went. Matters had not grown peacefuler meantime, but worse. The soldiers protected us from bodily damage, but as we passed through the great mob at the castle we were assailed with insults and shameful epithets. I bore it well enough, though, and said to myself with secret satisfaction, "In 3 or 4 short days, my lads, you will be employing your tongues in a different sort from this, and I shall be there to hear." To my mind these were as good as dead men. How many of them would still be alive after the rescue that was coming? Not more than enough to amuse the executioner a short half-hour, certainly. It turned out that the report was true. Joan had relapsed. She was sitting there in her chains, clothed again in her male attire. She accused nobody. That was her way. It was not in her character to hold a servant to account for what his master had made him do, and her mind had cleared now, and she knew that the advantage which had been taken of her the previous morning had its origin not in the subordinate, but in the master, Cochon. Here is what had happened. While Joan slept in the early morning of Sunday, one of the guards stole her female apparel and put her male attire in its place. When she woke, she asked for the other dress, but the guards refused to give it back. She protested and said she was forbidden to wear the male dress, but they continued to refuse. She had to have clothing for modesty's sake. Moreover, she saw that she could not save her life if she must fight for it against treacheries like this, so she put on the forbidden garments, knowing what the end would be. She was weary of the struggle, poor thing. We had followed in the wake of Cochon, the vice-inquisitor, and the others, 6 or 8, and when I saw Joan sitting there, despondent, forlorn, and still in chains, when I was expecting to find her situation so different, I did not know what to make of it. The shock was very great. I had doubted the relapse, perhaps. Possibly I had believed in it, but had not realized it. Cochon's victory was complete. He had had a harassed and irritated and disgusted look for a long time, but that was all gone now, and contentment and serenity had taken its place. His purple face was full of tranquil and malicious happiness. He went trailing his robes and stood grandly in front of Joan with his legs apart, and remained so more than a minute, gloating over her and enjoying the sight of this poor ruined creature who had won so lofty a place for him in the service of the meek and merciful Jesus, Savior of the world, Lord of the universe, in case England kept her promises to him, who kept no promises himself. Presently the judges began to question Joan. One of them, named Marguerite, who was a man with more insight than prudence, remarked upon Joan's change of clothing and said,
"There is something suspicious about this. How could it have come about without connivance on the part of others? Perhaps even something worse?" "Thousand devils!" screamed Cochon in a fury. "Will you shut your mouth?"
"Armagnac, traitor!"
shouted the soldiers on guard, and made a rush for Marguerite with their lances leveled. It was with the greatest difficulty that he was saved from being run through the body. He made no more attempts to help the inquiry, poor man. The other judges proceeded with the questionings.
why have you resumed this male habit?"
I did not quite catch her answer, for just then a soldier's halbert slipped from his fingers and fell on the stone floor with a crash, but I thought I understood Joan to say that she had resumed it of her own motion.
"But you have promised and sworn that you would not go back to it."
I was full of anxiety to hear her answer to that question, and when it came it was just what I was expecting. She said, quite quietly,
"I have never intended and never understood myself to swear I would not resume it."
There, I had been sure all along that she did not know what she was doing and saying on the platform Thursday, and this answer of hers was proof that I had not been mistaken. Then she went on to add this,
"But I had a right to resume it, because the promises made to me have not been kept, promises that I should be allowed to go to Mass and receive the communion, and that I should be freed from the bondage of these chains, but they are still upon me, as you see."
"Nevertheless, you have abjured, and have especially promised to return no more to the dress of a man."
Then Joan held out her fettered hand sorrowfully toward these unfeeling men, and said,
"I would rather die than continue so, but if they may be taken off, and if I may hear Mass, and be removed to a penitential prison, and have a woman about me, I will be good, and will do what shall seem good to you that I do."
Cochon sniffed scoffingly at that. Honor the compact which he and his had made with her? Fulfill its conditions? What need of that? Conditions had been a good thing to concede temporarily and for advantage, but they have served their turn. Let something of a fresher sort and of more consequence be considered. The resumption of the male dress was sufficient for all practical purposes, but perhaps Joan could be led to add something to that fatal crime. So Cochon asked her if her voices had spoken to her since Thursday, and he reminded her of her abjuration.
"Yes," she answered. And then it came out that the voices had talked with her about the abjuration, told her about it, I suppose. She guilelessly reasserted the heavenly origin of her mission, and did it with the untroubled mien of one who was not conscious that she had ever knowingly repudiated it. So I was convinced once more that she had had no notion of what she was doing that Thursday morning on the platform. Finally she said,
"My voices told me I did very wrong to confess that what I had done was not well."
Then she sighed, and said with simplicity,
"But it was the fear of the fire that made me do so."
That is, fear of the fire had made her sign a paper whose contents she had not understood then, but understood now by revelation of her voices and by testimony of her persecutors. She was sane now and not exhausted. Her courage had come back, and with it her inborn loyalty to the truth. She was bravely and serenely speaking it again, knowing that it would deliver her body up to that very fire which had such terrors for her. That answer of hers was quite long, quite frank, wholly free from concealments or palliations. It made me shudder. I knew she was pronouncing sentence of death upon herself. So did poor Manchon, and he wrote in the margin abreast of it, "Responsio mortifera," fatal answer. Yes, all present knew that it was, indeed, a fatal answer. Then there fell a silence such as falls in a sick-room when the watchers of the dying draw a deep breath and say softly to one another, "All is over." Here, likewise, all was over. But after some moments, Cochon, wishing to clinch this matter and make it final, put this question.
"Do you still believe that your voices are Saint Marguerite and Saint Catherine?"
"Yes, and that they come from God."
"Yet you denied them on the scaffold?"
Then she made direct and clear affirmation that she had never had any intention to deny them, and that if—I noted the if—if she had made some retractions and revocations on the scaffold, it was from fear of the fire, and it was a violation of the truth. There it is again, you see. She certainly never knew what it was she had done on the scaffold until she was told of it afterward by these people and by her voices. And now she closed this most painful scene with these words, and there was a weary note in them that was pathetic.
I would rather do my penance all at once. Let me die. I cannot endure captivity any longer."
The spirit, born for sunshine and liberty, so longed for release that it would take it in any form, even that. Several among the company of judges went from the place troubled and sorrowful, the others in another mood. In the court of the castle we found the Earl of Warwick and 50 English waiting, impatient for news. As soon as Cochon saw them, he shouted, laughing, "Think of a man destroying a friendless poor girl and then having the heart to laugh at it!
Make yourselves comfortable! It's all over with her!"
End of chapter 22. This is chapter 23 of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 3, Chapter 23, The Time is at Hand. The young can sink into abysses of despondency, and it was so with Noel and me now. But the hopes of the young are quick to rise again, and it was so with ours. We called back that vague promise of the voices, and said the one to the other that the glorious release was to happen at the last moment. That other time was not the last moment, but this is. It will happen now. The king will come, La Hire will come, and with them our veterans, and behind them all France. And so we were full of heart again, and could already hear in fancy that stirring music, the clash of steel and the war cries, and the uproar of the onset, and in fancy see our prisoner free, her chains gone, her sword in her hand. But this dream was to pass also and come to nothing. Late at night, when Manchon came in, he said,
"I am come from the dungeon, and I have a message for you from that poor child."
A message to me? If he had been noticing, I think he would have discovered me, discovered that my indifference concerning the prisoner was a pretense, for I was caught off my guard, and was so moved and so exalted to be so honored by her that I must have shown my feeling in my face and manner.
A message for me, your reverence?
Yes, it is something she wishes done. She said she had noticed the young man who helps me, and that he had a good face, and did I think he would do a kindness for her. I said I knew you would, and asked her what it was, and she said, a letter. Would you write a letter to her mother? And I said you would, but I said I would do it myself and gladly, but she said no, that my labors were heavy, and she thought the young man would not mind the doing of this service for one not able to do it for herself, she not knowing how to write. Then I would have sent for you, and at that the sadness vanished out of her face. Why, it was as if she was going to see a friend, poor friendless thing. But I was not permitted. I did my best, but the orders remain as strict as ever. The doors are closed against all but officials. As before, none but officials may speak to her. So I went back and told her, and she sighed, and was sad again. Now this is what she begs you to write to her mother. It is partly a strange message, and to me means nothing, but she said her mother would understand. You will convey her adoring love to her family and her village friends, and say there will be no rescue, for that this night, and it is the third time in the twelvemonth, and is final, she has seen the vision of the tree.
How strange!
Yes, it is strange, but that is what she said, and said her parents would understand, and for a little time she was lost in dreams and thinkings, and her lips moved, and I caught in her muttering these lines, which she said over two or three times, and they seemed to bring peace and contentment to her. I set them down, thinking they might have some connection with her letter and be useful, but it was not so. They were a mere memory, floating idly in a tired mind, and they have no meaning, at least no relevancy. I took the piece of paper and found what I knew I should find. And when in exile wandering we shall fainting yearn for glimpse of thee, O rise upon our sight. There was no hope any more. I knew it now. I knew that Joan's letter was a message to Noel and me, as well as to her family,
and that its object was to banish vain hopes from our minds and tell us from her own mouth of the blow that was going to fall upon us, so that we, being her soldiers, would know it for a command to bear it as became us and her, and so submit to the will of God, and in thus obeying find assuagement of our grief. It was like her, for she was always thinking of others, not of herself. Yes, her heart was sore for us. She could find time to think of us, the humblest of her servants, and try to soften our pain, lighten the burden of our troubles. She that was drinking of the bitter waters, she that was walking in the valley of the shadow of death. I wrote the letter. You will know what it cost me without my telling you. I wrote it with the same wooden stylus which had put upon parchment the first words ever dictated by Joan of Arc, that high summons to the English to vacate France 2 years past, when she was a lass of 17. It had now set down the last ones which she was ever to dictate. Then I broke it, for the pen that had served Joan of Arc could not serve any that would come after her in this earth without abasement. The next day, May 29th, Cochon summoned his serfs, and 42 responded. It is charitable to believe that the other 20 were ashamed to come. The 42 pronounced her a relapsed heretic, and condemned her to be delivered over to the secular arm. Cochon thanked them. Then he sent orders that Joan of Arc be conveyed the next morning to the place known as the Old Market, and that she be then delivered to the civil judge, and by the civil judge to the executioner. That meant she would be burnt. All the afternoon and evening of Tuesday the 29th, the news was flying, and the people of the countryside flocking to Rouen to see the tragedy, all, at least, who could prove their English sympathies and count upon admission. The press grew thicker and thicker in the streets, the excitement grew higher and higher, and now a thing was noticeable again which had been noticeable more than once before, that there was pity for Joan in the hearts of many of these people. Whenever she had been in great danger, it had manifested itself, and now it was apparent again, manifest in a pathetic, dumb sorrow which was visible in many faces. Early the next morning, Wednesday, Martin Ladvenu and another friar were sent to Joan to prepare her for death, and Manchon and I went with them, a hard service for me. We tramped through the dim corridors, winding this way and that, and piercing ever deeper and deeper into that vast heart of stone, and at last we stood before Joan. But she did not know it. She sat with her hands in her lap, and her head bowed, thinking, and her face was very sad. One might not know what she was thinking of her home, and the peaceful pastures, and the friends she was no more to see, of her wrongs, and her forsaken estate, and the cruelties which had been put upon her. Or was it of death, the death which she had longed for, and which was now so close? Or was it of the kind of death she must suffer? I hoped not, for she feared only one kind, and that one had for her unspeakable terrors. I believed she so feared that one that with her strong will she would shut the thought of it wholly out of her mind, and hope and believe that God would take pity on her and grant her an easier one. And so it might chance that the awful news which we were bringing might come as a surprise to her at last. We stood silent a while, but she was still unconscious of us, still deep in her sad musings and far away. Then Martin Ladvenu said softly, "Joan?" She looked up then, with a little start and a wan smile, and said, "Speak. Have you a message for me?" "Yes, poor child. Try to bear it. Do you think you can bear it?" "Yes," very softly, and her head drooped again. "I am come to prepare you for death." A faint shiver trembled through her wasted body. There was a pause. In the stillness we could hear our breathings. Then she said, still in that low voice, "When will it be?" The muffled notes of a tolling bell floated to our ears out of the distance. "Now, the time is at hand." That slight shiver passed again. "It is so soon, ah, it is so soon." There was a long silence.
The distant throbbings of the bell pulsed through it, and we stood motionless and listening, but it was broken at last.
"What death is it?"
"By fire."
"Oh, I knew it. I knew it."
She sprang wildly to her feet, and wound her hands in her hair, and began to writhe and sob, oh, so piteously, and mourn and grieve and lament, and turn to first one and then another of us, and search our faces beseechingly, as hoping she might find help and friendliness there, poor thing, she that had never denied these to any creature, even her wounded enemy on the battlefield.
"Oh, cruel, cruel, to treat me so! And must my body, that has never been defiled, be consumed to-day and turned to ashes? Ah, sooner would I that my head were cut off 7 times than suffer this woeful death. I had the promise of the church's prison when I submitted, and if I had but been there, and not left here in the hands of my enemies, this miserable fate had not befallen me. Oh, I appeal to God, the great judge, against the injustice which has been done me."
There was none there that could endure it. They turned away, with the tears running down their faces. In a moment I was on my knees at her feet. At once she thought only of my danger, and bent and whispered in my ear,
"Up! Do not peril yourself, good heart. There, God bless you always."
And I felt the quick clasp of her hand. Mine was the last hand she touched with hers in life. None saw it. History does not know of it or tell of it. Yet it is true, just as I have told it. The next moment she saw Cochon coming, and she went and stood before him and reproached him, saying,
"Bishop, it is by you that I die."
He was not shamed, not touched, but said smoothly,
"Ah, be patient, Joan. You die because you have not kept your promise, but have returned to your sins."
"Alas," she said, "if you had put me in the church's prison and given me right and proper keepers, as you promised, this would not have happened, and for this I summon you to answer before God."
Then Cochon winced, and looked less placidly content than before, and he turned him about and went away. Joan stood a while musing. She grew calmer, but occasionally she wiped her eyes, and now and then sobs shook her body. But their violence was modifying now, and the intervals between them were growing longer. Finally she looked up and saw Pierre Maurice, who had come in with the bishop, and she said to him,
"Master Peter, where shall I be this night?"
"Have you not good hope in God?"
"Yes, and by his grace I shall be in paradise."
Now Martin Ladvenu heard her in confession. Then she begged for the sacrament. But how grant the communion to one who had been publicly cut off from the church, and was now no more entitled to its privileges than an unbaptized pagan? The brother could not do this, but he sent to Cochon to inquire what he must do. All laws, human and divine, were alike to that man. He respected none of them. He sent back orders to grant Joan whatever she wished. Her last speech to him had reached his fears, perhaps. It could not reach his heart, for he had none. The Eucharist was brought now to that poor soul that had yearned for it with such unutterable longing all these desolate months. It was a solemn moment. While we had been in the deeps of the prison, the public courts of the castle had been filling up with crowds of the humbler sort of men and women who had learned what was going on in Joan's cell, and had come with softened hearts to do they knew not what, to hear they knew not what. We knew nothing of this, for they were out of our view, and there were other great crowds of the like cast gathered in masses outside the castle gates, and when the lights and the other accompaniments of the sacrament passed by, coming to Joan in the prison, all those multitudes kneeled down and began to pray for her, and many wept. And when the solemn ceremony of the communion began in Joan's cell, out of the distance a moving sound was borne moaning to our ears. It was those invisible multitudes chanting the litany for a departing soul. The fear of the fiery death was gone from Joan of Arc now, to come again no more, except for one fleeting instant, then it would pass, and serenity and courage would take its place and abide till the end. End of chapter 23. This is chapter 24 of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 3, Chapter 24, Joan the Martyr. At 9 o'clock, the Maid of Orléans, deliverer of France, went forth in the grace of her innocence and her youth to lay down her life for the country she loved with such devotion, and for the king that had abandoned her. She sat in the cart that is used only for felons. In one respect she was treated worse than a felon, for whereas she was on her way to be sentenced by the civil arm, she already bore her judgment inscribed in advance upon a mitre-shaped cap which she wore. Heretic, relapsed, apostate, idolater. In the cart with her sat the friar Martin Ladvenu and Maître Jean Massieu. She looked girlishly fair and sweet and saintly in her long white robe, and when a gush of sunlight flooded her as she emerged from the gloom of the prison and was yet for a moment still framed in the arch of the sombre gate, the massed multitudes of poor folk murmured, "A vision! A vision!" and sank to their knees praying, and many of the women weeping, and the moving invocation for the dying arose again, and was taken up and borne along, a majestic wave of sound which accompanied the doomed, solacing and blessing her all the sorrowful way to the place of death. "Christ have pity! Saint Margaret have pity! Pray for her, all ye saints, archangels and blessed martyrs! Pray for her! Saints and angels, intercede for her! From thy wrath, good Lord, deliver her! O Lord God, save her! Have mercy on her, we beseech thee, good Lord!" It is just and true what one of the histories has said. The poor and the helpless had nothing but their prayers to give Joan of Arc, but these we may believe were not unavailing. There are few more pathetic events recorded in history than this weeping, helpless, praying crowd, holding their lighted candles and kneeling on the pavement beneath the prison walls of the old fortress. And it was so all the way. Thousands upon thousands massed upon their knees and stretching far down the distances, thick sown with the faint yellow candle flames, like a field starred with golden flowers. But there were some that did not kneel. These were the English soldiers. They stood elbow to elbow on each side of Joan's road and walled it in all the way, and behind these living walls knelt the multitudes. By and by a frantic man in priest's garb came wailing and lamenting, and tore through the crowd and the barriers of soldiers, and flung himself on his knees by Joan's cart, and put up his hands in supplication, crying out, "Oh, forgive! Forgive!" It was Loiseleur, and Joan forgave him. Forgave him out of a heart that knew nothing but forgiveness, nothing but compassion, nothing but pity for all that suffer, let their offense be what it might. And she had no word of reproach for this poor wretch who had wrought day and night with deceits and treacheries and hypocrisies to betray her to her death. The soldiers would have killed him, but the Earl of Warwick saved his life. What became of him is not known. He hid himself from the world somewhere to endure his remorse as he might. In the square of the old market stood the two platforms and the stake that had stood before in the churchyard of Saint-Ouen. The platforms were occupied as before, the one by Joan and her judges, the other by great dignitaries, the principal being Cochon and the English cardinal Winchester. The square was packed with people. The windows and roofs of the blocks of buildings surrounded it were black with them. When the preparations had been finished, all noise and movement gradually ceased, and a waiting stillness followed which was solemn and impressive. And now, by order of Cochon, an ecclesiastic named Nicholas Midi preached a sermon, wherein he explained that when a branch of the vine, which is the church, becomes diseased and corrupt, it must be cut away, or it will corrupt and destroy the whole vine. He made it appear that Joan, through her wickedness, was a menace and a peril to the church's purity and holiness, and her death therefore necessary. When he was come to the end of his discourse, he turned toward her and paused a moment. Then he said,
Joan, the church can no longer protect you. Go in peace.
Joan had been placed wholly apart and conspicuous to signify the church's abandonment of her, and she sat there in her loneliness, waiting in patience and resignation for the end. Cochon addressed her now. He had been advised to read the form of her abjuration to her, and had brought it with him. But he changed his mind, fearing that she would proclaim the truth, that she had never knowingly abjured, and so bring shame upon him and eternal infamy. He contented himself with admonishing her to keep in mind her wickedness, and repent of it, and think of her salvation. Then he solemnly pronounced her excommunicate, and cut off from the body of the church. With a final word he delivered her over to the secular arm for judgment and sentence. Joan, weeping, knelt and began to pray. For whom? Herself? Oh, no. For the King of France. Her voice rose sweet and clear, and penetrated all hearts with its passionate pathos. She never thought of his treacheries to her. She never thought of his desertion of her. She never remembered that it was because he was an ingrate that she was here to die a miserable death. She remembered only that he was her king, that she was his loyal and loving subject, and that his enemies had undermined his cause with evil reports and false charges, and he not by to defend himself. And so, in the very presence of death, she forgot her own troubles to implore all in her hearing to be just to him, to believe that he was good and noble and sincere, and not in any way to blame for any acts of hers, neither advising them nor urging them, but being wholly clear and free of all responsibility for them. Then, closing, she begged in humble and touching words that all here present would pray for her and would pardon her, both her enemies and such as might look friendly upon her and feel pity for her in their hearts. There was hardly one heart there that was not touched, even the English. Even the judges showed it, and there was many a lip that trembled and many an eye that was blurred with tears. Yes, even the English cardinals, that man with a political heart of stone, but a human heart of flesh. The secular judge who should have delivered judgment and pronounced sentence was himself so disturbed that he forgot his duty, and Joan went to her death unsentenced, thus completing with an illegality what had begun illegally, and had so continued to the end. He only said to the guards, "Take her," and to the executioner, "Do your duty." Joan asked for a cross. None was able to furnish one, but an English soldier broke a stick in two and crossed the pieces and tied them together, and this cross he gave her, moved to it by the good heart that was in him, and she kissed it and put it in her bosom. Then Isambert de la Prière went to the church nearby and brought her a consecrated one, and this one also she kissed, and pressed it to her bosom with rapture, and then kissed it again and again, covering it with tears, and pouring out her gratitude to God and the saints. And so, weeping, and with her cross to her lips, she climbed up the cruel steps to the face of the stake, with the friar Isambard at her side. Then she was helped up to the top of the pile of wood that was built around the lower third of the stake, and stood upon it, with her back against the stake, and the world gazing up at her, breathless. The executioner ascended to her side and wound chains around her slender body, and so fastened her to the stake. Then he descended to finish his dreadful office, and there she remained alone, she that had had so many friends in the days when she was free, and had been so loved and so dear. All these things I saw, albeit dimly and blurred with tears, but I could bear no more. I continued in my place, but what I shall deliver to you now I got by others' eyes and others' mouths. Tragic sounds there were that pierced my ears and wounded my heart as I sat there, but it is, as I tell you, the latest image recorded by my eyes in that desolating hour was Joan of Arc with the grace of her comely youth still unmarred, and that image, untouched by time or decay, has remained with me all my days. Now I will go on.
if any thought that now, in that solemn hour when all transgressors repent and confess, she would revoke her revocation and say her great deeds had been evil deeds, and Satan and his friends their source, they erred. No such thought was in her blameless mind. She was not thinking of herself and her troubles, but of others, and of woes that might befall them. And so, turning her grieving eyes about her, where rose the towers and spires of that fair city, she said,
"Oh, Rouen! Rouen, must I die here, and must you be my tomb? Ah, Rouen! Rouen, I have great fear that you will suffer for my death."
A whiff of smoke swept upward past her face, and for one moment terror seized her, and she cried out,
"Water! Give me holy water!"
But the next moment her fears were gone, and they came no more to torture her. She heard the flames crackling below her, and immediately distress for a fellow creature who was in danger took possession of her. It was the friar Isambard. She had given him her cross and begged him to raise it toward her face and let her eyes rest in hope and consolation upon it till she was entered into the peace of God. She made him go out from the danger of the fire. Then she was satisfied and said,
"Now keep it always in my sight until the end."
Not even yet could Cochon, that man without shame, endure to let her die in peace, but went toward her, all black with crimes and sins as he was, and cried out,
"I am come, Joan, to exhort you for the last time to repent and seek the pardon of God."
"I die through you," she said,
and these were the last words she spoke to any upon earth. Then the pitchy smoke, shot through with red flashes of flame, rolled up in a thick volume and hid her from sight. And from the heart of this darkness her voice rose strong and eloquent in prayer. And when by moments the wind shredded somewhat of the smoke aside, there were veiled glimpses of an upturned face and moving lips. At last a mercifully swift tide of flame burst upward, and none saw that face any more, nor that form, and the voice was still. Yes, she was gone from us. Joan of Arc. What little words they are, to tell of a rich world made empty and poor. End of chapter 24. This is the conclusion of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 3, Conclusion. Joan's brother Jacques died in Domremy during the great trial at Rouen. This was according to the prophecy which Joan made that day in the pastures, the time that she said the rest of us would go to the great wars. When her poor old father heard of the martyrdom, it broke his heart, and he died. The mother was granted a pension by the city of Orléans, and upon this she lived out her days, which were many. 24 years after her illustrious child's death, she traveled all the way to Paris in the winter time, and was present at the opening of the discussion in the Cathedral of Notre Dame, which was the first step in the rehabilitation. Paris was crowded with people from all about France, who came to get sight of the venerable dame, and it was a touching spectacle when she moved through these reverend wet-eyed multitudes on her way to the grand honors awaiting her at the cathedral. With her were Jean and Pierre, no longer the light-hearted youths who marched with us from Vaucouleurs, but war-torn veterans with hair beginning to show frost. After the martyrdom, Noel and I went back to Domremy, but presently, when the constable Richemont superseded La Tremouille as the king's chief adviser and began the completion of Joan's great work, we put on our harness and returned to the field and fought for the king all through the wars and skirmishes until France was freed of the English. It was what Joan would have desired of us, and, dead or alive, her desire was law for us. All the survivors of the personal staff were faithful to her memory and fought for the king to the end. Mainly we were well scattered, but when Paris fell, we happened to be together, It was a great day and a joyous, but it was a sad one at the same time, because Joan was not there to march into the captured capital with us. Noel and I remained always together, and I was by his side when death claimed him. It was in the last great battle of the war. In that battle fell also Joan's sturdy old enemy, Talbot. He was 85 years old, and had spent his whole life in battle. A fine old lion he was, with his flowing white mane and his tameless spirit. Yes, and his indestructible energy as well, for he fought as knightly and vigorous a fight that day as the best man there. La Hire survived the martyrdom 13 years, and all was fighting, of course, for that was all he enjoyed in life. I did not see him in all that time, for we were far apart, but one was always hearing of him. The bastard of Orléans and d'Alençon and d'Olon lived to see France free, and to testify with Jean and Pierre d'Arc and Pasquerelle and me at the rehabilitation. But they are all at rest now these many years. I alone am left of those who fought at the side of Joan of Arc in the great wars. She said I would live until those wars were forgotten, a prophecy which failed. If I should live 1,000 years, it would still fail, for whatsoever had touched with Joan of Arc, that thing is immortal. Members of Joan's family married, and they have left descendants. Their descendants are of the nobility, but their family name and blood bring them honors which no other nobles receive or may hope for. You have seen how everybody along the way uncovered when those children came yesterday to pay their duty to me. It was not because they are noble. It is because they are grandchildren of the brothers of Joan of Arc. Now, as to the rehabilitation, Joan crowned the king at Reims. For reward, he allowed her to be hunted to her death without making one effort to save her. During the next 23 years, he remained indifferent to her memory, indifferent to the fact that her good name was under a damning blot, put there by the priest because of the deeds which she had done in saving him and his scepter, indifferent to the fact that France was ashamed and longed to have the deliverer's fair fame restored, indifferent all that time. Then he suddenly changed and was anxious to have justice for poor Joan himself. Why? Had he become grateful at last? Had remorse attacked his hard heart? No, he had a better reason, a better one for his sort of man. This better reason was that, now that the English had been finally expelled from the country, they were beginning to call attention to the fact that this king had gotten his crown by the hands of a person proven by the priests to have been in league with Satan, and burned for it by them as a sorceress. Therefore, of what value or authority was such a kingship as that? Of no value at all. No nation could afford to allow such a king to remain on the throne. It was high time to stir now, and the king did it. That is how Charles VII came to be smitten with anxiety to have justice done to the memory of his benefactress. He appealed to the Pope, and the Pope appointed a great commission of churchmen to examine into the facts of Joan's life and award judgment. The commission sat at Paris, at Domremy, at Rouen, at Orléans, and at several other places, and continued its work during several months. It examined the records of Joan's trials. It examined the Bastard of Orléans, and the Duc d'Alençon, and d'Olon, and Pasquerelle, and Courcelle, and Isambard de la Pierre, and Manchon, and me, and many others whose names I have made familiar to you. Also they examined more than 100 witnesses whose names are less familiar to you, the friends of Joan in Domremy, Vaucouleurs, Orléans, and other places, and a number of judges and other people who had assisted at the Rouen trials, the abjuration, and the martyrdom. And out of this exhaustive examination Joan's character and history came spotless and perfect, and this verdict was placed upon record to remain forever. I was present upon most of these occasions, and saw again many faces which I have not seen for a quarter of a century, many of them well-beloved faces, those of our generals and that of Catherine Boucher, married, alas, and also among them certain other faces that filled me with bitterness, those of Beaupère and Courcelle and a number of their fellow fiends. I saw Omette and little Manguette edging along toward 50 now, and mothers of many children. I saw Noel's father, and the parents of the Paladin and the Sunflower. It was beautiful to hear the Duc d'Alençon praise Joan's splendid capacities as a general, and to hear the bastard endorse these praises with his eloquent tongue, and then go on and tell how sweet and good Joan was, and how full of pluck and fire and impetuosity and mischief and mirthfulness and tenderness and compassion and everything that was pure and fine and noble and lovely. He made her live again before me and wrung my heart. I have finished my story of Joan of Arc, that wonderful child, that sublime personality, that spirit which in one regard has had no peer and will have none, this, its purity from all alloy of self-seeking, self-interest, personal ambition. In it no trace of these motives can be found, search as you may. And this cannot be said of any other person whose name appears in profane history. With Joan of Arc, love of country was more than a sentiment. It was a passion. She was the genius of patriotism. She was patriotism embodied, concreted, made flesh and palpable to the touch and visible to the eye. Love, mercy, charity, fortitude, war, peace, poetry, music, these may be symbolized as any shall prefer, by figures of either sex and of any age, but a slender girl in her first young bloom, with the martyr's crown upon her head, and in her hand the sword that severed her country's bonds, shall not this and no other stand for patriotism through all the ages until time shall end? End of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Your reader, John Greenman.